Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for January 2nd, 2020. Wow, this is the first show of this next year, of this next decade. And it's always kind of a something we look at as a time marker, a time stamp, to see what kind of progress the human race is making. And I'd say not a lot overall. I think we're in pretty tenuous waters right now. That's the best I could say, although it's certainly much better than the people get into politics and things like that. But where things were supposed to be was the United States was supposed to be a basically authoritarian government with lacking no more freedom of speech, no more gun rights, and that's an important thing. It's really the only thing that governments understand is when the citizenry is armed, and this goes all the way back through history. Let's take medieval England for example. The way they controlled the public and the way they still control the public is back in the Middle Ages, they had sheriffs that they put out in the communities. And basically, the people were peasants at the time. You had the peasantry and you had the nobility. And the way the nobility kept their power to this day was to keep the arms out of the hands of the commoners. And so what they did, but it was kind of like a catch-22. They needed the commoners to be adept at warfare in case the country was invaded. They needed those people to understand how to basically a controlled militia in a sense. But on the Sundays, they would go out, they would use the religious day off, so to speak, and they would get the people out and have a big picnic. The women would cook and prepare the food, and the men would be out in the fields with the archery equipment, which was stored at the sheriff's location. And so on that day, they would let the archery equipment out, and the men would go practice at what they were called the butts. The butts were big piles of dirt that were out in an open field, and they would do what was known as clout shooting. Still, it's a common sport today in archery. And clout shooting is where you take and see who can get the closest to a target at a long distance. In other words, you just shoot the arrow way up in the air in a long distance, the farthest distance. And the idea was that you would blanket an area with arrows. And that's what they did, for example, at the Battle of Agincourt, where they just completely decimated 10,000 French knights in about 2 hours. Probably less than that, that the entire battle raged. The English had about 6,000 troops, but of those troops, about 500 were archers, and they could rapid fire. So once they were given the order to shoot, they just covered an area with arrows, and these were big war bows with war arrows that could pierce armor, and nothing could get through there. They killed the horses, the men, killed everything in its path. But the point is that the royalty knew this, that an armed citizenry would be a great challenge to their authority. And so they only allowed the peasantry to be armed on a certain day of the year and under very controlled circumstances, because they knew that the peasantry, if armed, could rise up easily and overtake the nobility. So the nobility lived out amongst the countryside on their estates and their beautiful mansions, etc. And the poor people lived as they were called paupers. And much of the game of chess revolves around this concept of nobility in the pawns, and that the pawns were the first one to get killed. The nobility would be back there, and of course the king would be the ultimate person that would be killed And so it was a matter of survival. And so the modern day game of chess existed back then, but it was based on this concept of the little guy dies and the wealthy nobility. And of course, you still have that in England, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And the House of Lords can lord over the House of Commons. And so that's what we got away from in the Revolutionary War. And the whole idea there was it put the individual in, was more important than the state. Now you have politicians saying, we live in a land, this is a quote from a recent woman who is an elected official in Congress, and she said this is an elected official in the state of Virginia where all this tumultuous activity is going on. But she said, we live in a state of laws and people are subordinate to the laws. In other words, if you can pass a law, then everybody has to be subordinate to the state. And so that's the exact opposite of what the intention of the United States is. So at any rate, the control of arms is important for the citizens. It's the only way the citizenry really retains a vote. Now, I want to reiterate also that I did the voter study showing that there was massive voter fraud in the 2016 election. And that is still going on. It's much worse right now. And you can see, for example, in the state of Virginia, you have 92 of 95 counties declaring themselves sanctuary counties against impending laws of taking away free speech, taking away arms, taking away jobs from people in the security or police or National Guard, etc., taking away their employment if they don't support the laws of the state, which are clearly unconstitutional laws. But and then, of course, turning millions of ordinary regular people into felons overnight by a stroke of the pen. At any rate, the point I want to make here is that now they're calling for an assembly in Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia, which is like, let me explain the demographics here a little bit. Richmond, Virginia is the high population area of the state. Most of the people there really live there in a bedroom community. They work in Washington, D.C., and their employment, which they make a lot of money. These people, I mean, they have the best life. They work in D.C., they make a lot of money, and they live in Richmond, Virginia. And so they are the controlling, basically, vote in the entire state of Virginia. But most of the state of Virginia is rural. Regular poor people, and of course hunting is a big thing there, arms is a big thing, and so this is coming to a head, and they want to assemble on January 20th, and somebody has got this thing where they're going to all get together and somehow show solidarity in Richmond. So they want to stick it in the face, so to speak, of the of the capital, which is in Richmond, Virginia. But the problem here is this is a setup. And very clearly, not all the people involved in this are, it started out, I believe, as a kind of a homebrewed movement to assemble a public assembly on the 20th and all these people carrying arms. But what's becoming clear is this is a setup to have a so-called false flag incident occur where they bring in people to mix with the militias and start a shooting war, making them look like a bunch of crazies, killing some innocent people, and then they come in and they're going to come in with UN troops and they're going to go, oh, we can't let these citizens have guns. They're all crazy, you know, and that's what is going to happen. So I don't give advice on this show, but from everything I can see, people should call this event off and just say, hey, this is turning into disaster, and we have to find some other way to make our point. In fact, people would be much better off just staying at home and protecting your castle. And that's what the militia is really about. It's not about going and organizing. If they put themselves in one spot, and see, this would affect the rest of the country, because then the arms, the anti-arms people would come up and say, well, look at, we can't have all these crazy people having arms, and then try and use that as an example to spread it through the entire country. So this is a test point right here, and it's coming up very quickly. So if you're not aware of this, I think you should become aware of this and then also realize that this is a trap. And any time, not that it started out that way, but any time the government has a chance to you know, use some event for its advantage, and it, this goes back to the Middle Ages. That's why I was talking about Old England. Because the government does not want an armed population, because they fear that their power could go in a flash overnight. They don't want the public to have any say in anything. And that's the political attitude. And it does not matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. That's pretty much the way the government operates. So anyway, sorry to start out this year with that, but it's possibly one of the most important things coming up in this entire decade. Just like 9/11, remember, that happened shortly after the beginning of the last decade, or the first decade of the 21st century here. Remember, that happened right at the beginning of George Bush Jr.'s role as president, and that has carried, dominated the political landscape since then. I mean, it was just like the entire world changed because of that, and not in a good way. And so I think this event in Richmond, Virginia, is going to go down in history as a turning point in the battle to bear arms or not to bear arms. And this is, like I say, this is a setup. It may not have started that way, but it's turning into that. And they will have, the government is able to put agents out there, possibly thousands, possibly 5,000, to make this event into the biggest colossal mess you have ever seen. And then they can come in and say, ugh, we can't let these citizens have guns. Look at what they're doing. They think they're military. They come in and shoot up the town. And no, this is a setup. So just beware about that. There was a story that it's so blatant. There was a story this past week that Trump is against science. Now, I talk about science all the time on this show, and the science, the so-called science coming out of government science, is garbage. It, my opinion is that all government support of science should just stop, because what you're getting is a lot of fluff. These people are making their livings off of your, basically, off the backs of the public, and they're not producing good science. What they're producing is the same old science, because that's what gives them the same old paycheck. It's as simple as that. So government science is bad science. And, from the very beginning, when I, 20 years ago, I put out my books for the general public, The Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, and the series of books. Most of those rolled out in the early 2000s, and they're still very valid. I wrote those books for all time. So people will be reading those books in 100 and in 200 years, and they also give the flavor of government-supported science. And one of the things I did in there is dispel the myth of what I call the axioms of astronomy. These are like axiomatic myths or starting points that must be followed if you're going to do science today. And they're totally incorrect. They're totally bogus. you know, the Big Bang and the idea that the solar system began 4.5 billion years ago completely could not possibly be true. And, of course, that ties into evolution, cosmological evolution, or that comets are dirty snowballs, which is could not possibly be true. The European Space Agency has landed on the surface of a comet. There's no ice, there's no snow, there's no fountains of water coming off the comet nucleus, nothing. Yet they keep talking about this. These are, science is fairy tale. The Big Bang and the electrically neutral universe. I get the regular newsletter from the American Geophysical Union. I used to go to these trying to make a difference. And what I realized is these people, these government scientists, there'd be, you know, at an average American Geophysical Union, the annual meeting, there'll be 20,000 scientists. And every one of them there is on the payroll. They're going there for free. I call them scientific vacations. So when they say Trump is against science, what he wants to do is cut their budgets. And, of course, he's not cutting NASA's budget. He knows that's politically incorrect. So he knows where, you know, he has to toe the party line, so to speak, because cutting funds at NASA at any program is typically political suicide. It's, you know, it just covers so many people's salaries. There's so many people employed as a result of NASA. And people with high-paying jobs in, you know, industry and the aerospace industry, etc. There's so much money that goes out, and then they have people in little job shops all around the country making this little piece or that little piece, and it's all on the assumption that NASA is doing good science. I'm going to talk about the Armitis NASA Artemis, yeah, mission. Supposedly, where NASA is going to go to the moon. Oh, geez. I saw a kind of a promotion for this and how they're going to do it, and they're going to preload things on the moon so that when the astronauts get there, they got all their stuff sitting there waiting for them to accomplish more things. And literally, NASA has never, ever done any of these things ever in its history besides building another big rocket. That's bigger than the Saturn V, which had some serious problems, by the way. You saw those things going off. And one of the issues is that the main engines didn't work. And they didn't have the capability of lifting as much. The rocket went off, but they could not carry the load necessary to get them to the moon. That's another little problem that the Apollo space program had that nobody talked about. They could get that Saturn V and its payload into low Earth orbit, but they couldn't lift all of the necessities to get it up to take it to the moon. So that was just a little issue, but now they claim they're going to build another rocket that's actually bigger than the Saturn V, something based on the space shuttle design where they have solid boosters on the side, which was a terrible design. That was the main reason for the failure of the Challenger accidents where the O-rings burned through and the solid boosters. You know, and they're going to try and do that again on this rocket. It's a bad design. It's a bad design. I mean, the Russians have heavy lift rockets. Why don't they just buy a couple of those? They're very reliable. They use kerosene, not liquid oxygen. They've been using these things since the 1960s. They're super reliable. And NASA thinks it's going to build another rocket. Just fairy tales. I mean, they're just in la la land. There are so many things that have to work 100% correct for this next Artemis mission to work. And by the way, the promotion was a cartoon. It was a cartoon showing all the glorious things that NASA was going to do. and bring the astronauts back safely at home so to advance science. It was a cartoon. There wasn't a single shred of real hardware or anything real. It was a cartoon. And so anyway, now they're claiming that Trump is against science. Well, if I were president, I would simply chop all science, any government support of science. If scientists have the ability, if they have real science, then it should be marketable. The entire space program should have been marketed out a long time ago for space manufacturing, for space tourism, for all kinds of things, people living on outer space, doing business in outer space. That should have been done, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And they're still doing this, oh, let's go back to the moon. It's still the same old Apollo program. So say they get two guys on the moon. What is it going to accomplish? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's just going to be more sugar piled on sugar, piled on sugar. But they're not going to get there because they never, in their little cartoon, they never mention radiation, which is the biggest issue with space travel. So for somebody to say that anybody is against science, what is the use of that science as a catch-all term, if as if this is somehow ordained by God or something? You know, their science is garbage. It should not be funded. It should be just thrown in the garbage can, and all these people should go out and get real jobs. That's what it amounts to. There, you know, what you're being presented, the science that you're being presented is literally garbage. And speaking of government science and garbage, this whole thing of global climate change, the whole issue should end. And I'll just very simply, if somebody's listening to this show for the first time, the very simple issue is that every day the nuclear power plants and the coal power plants and the automobile that you drive down the road every day is belching out vast amounts of heat in real time. You don't have to wait 20 years for some kind of greenhouse effect and carbon dioxide to cause heating. You know, all of these heat engines, which we use to power our energy needs, automobiles, coal power plants, natural gas power plants, or any kind of nuclear or any kind of future nuclear, whether or geothermal is a terrible source of energy because it's lifting up heat that's stored in the earth and converting it into energy, and about 80% of that heat goes right into the atmosphere. But the point is that if atmospheric heating is an issue, which it's not, then we should be experiencing it on a daily basis. Huge amounts of heat are being dumped into the atmosphere, and every night when the earth goes into nighttime, it releases all that heat. That heat goes up and goes away, goes into outer space. And so it's not heating up the atmosphere. So you don't have to wait 20 years for carbon dioxide to somehow heat the atmosphere, which it doesn't. It is not a greenhouse. A greenhouse has a glass roof, and that's what traps the heat in. Our atmosphere does not have a glass roof. And the carbon dioxide is one out of every 10,000 molecules is carbon dioxide. It's 0.04% of the atmospheric content. And so it does not constitute some kind of glass ceiling that the heat that traps the heat in. It just doesn't. I've given this example. Take a table and put 10,000 golf balls out there, white golf balls, and paint one of them black. This is a table with 10,000 golf balls on it. You put one black one out there, that is the carbon dioxide molecule equivalent in the atmosphere. The atmosphere is not blocking heat due to carbon dioxide. This is ridiculous. What we have is science by emotion. They've gotten people all worked up, and there's no issue here. The real issue is that we should not be burning coal and nuclear and natural gas and all of these other inert fuels are using geothermal or thorium or fusion or any other source of heat to create our energy. It's a terrible way. It's a terribly inefficient way of creating energy. It's called the Carnot cycle, and at best, it's about 33% efficient. But after you add in all the other inefficiencies, it comes down to about 20%. And so 80% of the heat being generated today goes right into the atmosphere. And nobody, all of these scientists, once again, bad science, bad scientists. You know, so all of these highfalutin scientists, no matter which side of this argument they're on, are bogus. And, you know, I deal with people all the time because I'm in the energy business, literally with the wing generator and also the water industry. There's another false, totally false science that somehow we have a water shortage. We don't have a water shortage. We have a water management problem. We live on a planet that's two-thirds water. We have vast amounts of fresh water, which in the United States is highly polluted. And that's the economic model that everybody in the world wants to follow. Which brings up another point. If we're looking in the future, this is 2020, we're supposed to be being looking into the future. How long can the United States and what they call advanced economies, how long can they sustain this 40-hour-a-week job with everybody owning a brand new car and a nice new house, and how long, you know, manufacturing and, you know, all kinds of new trinkets. Look at all of the new trinkets and gadgets that are out there this year, say just for Christmas. Look at all the new things that you could buy this year for Christmas that were not there last year. So in a sense, that's good. But then in another sense, how long is this going to go on? How many new trinkets and widgets and gadgets can you manufacture and think of? You know, mainly for smartphones and other things like that. But how long is this going to go on? I mean, after 1,000 years, do you need are we going to have 60G cell phone service, you know, in 10 years? After 4G and then 5G and then 6G and then 7G and, you know, there's an insanity here that, you know, where's it going to all end? Where's this thing going to go? I mean, is the best thing we can do have everybody employed? That's the best thing that you can do now because it's a way for people to be independent. They have an income. They're working for that. There's proposals to have guaranteed income. But if you have the rest of the people working to provide that guaranteed income, then that's not a a viable economic system. If the government goes back to just producing money, which it was supposed to do, then okay, then you could do that. But in the current system of taxation, of taking money from some people and giving it to others, then, as Ronald Reagan said, socialism is fine until you run out of everybody's money. And then it comes to a screeching halt, and the same thing happens that has happened in every country that's installed socialism. It comes to one day it ends, and everybody ends up broke, and nobody has anything. And then they're standing around trying to figure out what happened. At any rate, so looking into the future, there has to be something after mass capitalism. There has to be, you know, I mean, if you're talking about your grandchildren or your grandchildren's children, people that have not even been born yet, are they going to be working 40-hour-a-week jobs and producing new widgets and marketing them? And, you know, is that what the future of humankind is going to be, or is there something else in our future? There were civilizations, Lemuria is one of them, that lived in a very natural setting, and they spent their time on higher social goals. communication and things like that. At the same time, they coexisted with Atlantis. This is the story that comes to us through history. This, you won't find this in your history book, by the way, which is another completely false set of just trash. Lemuria was a place where they concentrated on developing the person. And it's kind of like the Greek attitude of the complete person, physically, mentally, spiritually, socially, in all aspects, that you develop people, young people, and with something that is not done today. You sit kids in a classroom at a desk for 12 years and call it education, absolutely absurd, where everybody learns the same thing and you call that education? Oh, what a tragedy. What a just should be absolutely illegal. But get back to some topics. But it's good that people are finally waking up that global climate change is a myth. And one by one, people are realizing that, hey, this was never an issue. And I've made this statement also, that global climate change was actually instigated and promoted by the energy companies, because it took the heat off them, in a sense. It was always like, oh, we're going to be 20% independent in 10 years. And people would think, oh, that's a goal we can reach. And it's, politicians grabbed onto it and tried to be green. Then they have these goals that are futuristic, but when you look at them, that they couldn't possibly be reached ever. There's no way to reach these insurmountable goals, no matter how much money. And it's like, oh, this is your World War II. I'm sorry. Anybody that makes a statement like that is crazy. If you understand World War II and the human suffering and tragedy that went on there, what people are experiencing today is not, believe me, the equivalent of World War II. And I think that's one of the problems, is young people today don't have real issues. Like when I was going to college, we had the Vietnam War. You know, my buddies were coming back mentally, deranged from the severe, war conditions, jungle warfare, hand-to-hand combat in the jungles of, South Vietnam, or dead, or with body parts missing, and very, psychologically trauma, etc. This is what our generation dealt with, and this was forced on us by the government, who had to keep those wars going to keep the money going into the pockets of the rich people. So, people today, kids today, don't have real issues, and so they create issues that are just not there. Also, these are, they're not educated, so they can't see through them, and that's one of the big issues also. Okay, I'm going to go on to, that's kind of the beginning of this year, but I'm going to stay away from political type of topics. Here's an interesting thing. This is dealing with the social development of the human mind. Is the human mind only sees things in units of three. And so if you have one thing, let's take an example. If you have one apple on a table and you say, how many apples are there? You say, oh, there's one. You put two apples on a table and say, how many apples are there? There's two. You put three apples on a table. You say, how many apples are there? You look at it in your brain and your eye recognition says, oh, there's three. But if you put four apples on a table and you ask the person, how many apples are on the table? Their brain automatically divides it up into three and one. And so the brain limit, in a sense, is three things in a grouping. And that's just the way the human brain works. And so there are many things in life that are in threes. And I won't go into those. You could probably think of probably five or six of them offhand. But After three, the human brain needs to step back and put them together in smaller groups. So one way of doing this, if you have larger groups, is to put them in rows and columns. And so if you have, let's say, 50 things, 50 apples on a table, well, if they're just scattered all around and somebody says, how many are there? This is a problem that the Greeks had. Or let me rephrase that. This is the problem that was recognized first in modern-day history. I mean, sure, people understood this before the Greeks, because the human populations go way back in history. The history you've been taught about the human race is completely bogus. The races of man go very far back into history. But anyway, the idea of three. And so the solution that was first, in our modern history at least, was first enumerated by the Greeks, the modern Greeks living in around, time B.C., so to speak, was to put them in rows and columns. So if you have 50 apples on a table, then if you arrange them in rows of five and 10, five rows, 10 columns, then you could say, oh, there's 5 and 10. Okay, then if you knew your multiplication tables, you'd say there's 50. But what if there's 53? Then there's really no way to put these in rows and columns because 53 is a prime number. And so then let's take something like, what if you had 3,049 apples on a table? How could you put those in rows and columns? Well, that brings up the issue of prime numbers. 3,049 just happens to be a prime number. There's no way to neatly put these in rows and columns. And so the Romans would talk about legions. So legions were divisions of military troops. And when they marched out in the field, they would be in groups, in groupings, so that their commander could stand back and see how many were still standing after a battle, etc. So they understood the importance of grouping. And they were always wrestling with this concept of what they call prime numbers. That was the term given to these special numbers by Greeks. But going back to the very basic of three, that the human mind only perceives small groups of things up to three. And so it's important when, let's say you're developing your ability to do complicated math problems. What you are doing is overcoming your mind's natural tendencies to limit the way you can see things. So you're developing your mind to solve more complicated and more complicated problems. And this is why a lot of people have trouble with mathematics, is because somewhere along the line, they lost the chain. They lost an important concept in mathematics. And so therefore they couldn't go on and they didn't have the discipline. So we're talking about discipline here. We're talking about the ability of people to concentrate for long periods of time. And that's something that's totally lost. If you have a mind that's not disciplined, in every 15 seconds, you're getting a text and you have to respond to that text. You're reacting and your span of concentration becomes less and less. And so that's why kids today have no attention span, and that's why they're easily controlled, and that's why you have basically the conditions that there's different terms for them. Some people say millennials or things like that. That's just an age group. But also there's conditions. These people grew up with cell phones in their hands and responding to texts, et cetera, and they did not, they had music, they had a lot of distractions, and they did not have good concentration time when they were studying. And the parents possibly lived in the same world, so they didn't even know it. They didn't know that they were not providing their kids with a good environment for study. And so that's why in foreign countries, students are far advanced from kids in the United States, sometimes up to four grade levels advanced over what kids learn in the U.S. because the U.S. educational system stopped advancing 50 years ago. They're still doing the same thing that they did 50 years ago. And I can tell you from education that schools labor over topics. If you take too long to teach a topic, especially in like mathematics or something, if you take too long, then the people, it's more difficult for people to get it. And this is a good example. When I tutored the Tulane football team, we just right now are in the LSU, which Tulane used to play in the old Sugar Bowl there on Tulane campus, held 100,000 people. It was the biggest stadium in the country at the time. But the that's the old Sugar Bowl, open-air stadium. It was on Tulane campus. But the point is that that I tutored the Tulane football team. That was a way when I was in graduate school there. I was in graduate school at Tulane University for nuclear and solid-state physics. That's my advanced physics degree. Anyway, I tutored the Tulane football team, and I had like 1 hour. These guys were very busy. They had other classes they had to do good in. They had to maintain their grades. And so I had to take them in an hour time. A lot of times it was like an hour, maybe twice a week or something like that. And I would concentrate their physics studies into an hour, and I'd say, okay, here's the way it goes. This is, and they understood physics. So here you had big linemen, you know, that were going to be professional linemen in the professional football league someday. And that those years, Tulane was national rated, just like LSU is today. And I had these guys getting A's in physics, all of them. They called me in because they thought something was going on here. How could all these football players be getting A's in physics? And it's because I could teach them. I could concentrate that material in a short amount of time. They understood it. They went in and they got A's. But what happens in education today is they spend far too much time teaching topics. They draw it out, and it's just like, good grief. By the time you get done with a class, you don't even want to see a vector or a integral or something. I'll tell you another little story about my experience in education. When I was at Cornell University, one of the other calculus instructors was a pre-tenure professor there. He had to go on leave, and so I had to take over his calculus class. They said, you know, you have the time available for his time slot. Can you take over his calculus class? And I said, yeah, I can do that. Fine. So I did. So I go into class the first day. Is his class, 395 students, you know, big auditorium classroom, and the kids up in the top row, you could just barely see them. And so I go in, and I start, okay, here's the lesson, and I start talking about the day's lesson, and I'm not 5 minutes into it, and this kid raises his hands, and he says, hey, we don't know what a limit is. And I said, what do you mean you don't know what a limit is? I said, that was week one. We're in week, like, six of the semester. And then another kid raises his hand. He says, yeah, we don't know anything. This guy comes in, he turns his back, he writes on the board, he writes his stuff, mumbles, and he leaves. And I go, holy crap. These kids are 6 weeks at Cornell University. They're paying $60,000 a year. This is back in like 1980. And these students had been there 6 weeks and hadn't learned a thing. I'm going, oh my goodness. So I realized I had to bring these people up to speed. 6 weeks of calculus and they didn't know anything. Holy cow, how do I work with this one? So I came around to the front of the big, big desk. It was like one of these big chemistry desks. And that's, by the way, when they had blackboards with chalk back in the chalk and blackboard days. I came around to the front, and I sat up on the desk, which was high, and my feet were dangling off the front. And I said, okay, listen. And I took them in a couple lessons. I took them through the entire first 6 weeks of the class with my hands and showing them and talking about limits and limits from the right and limits from the left and limits that, you know, the Cauchy limits and Riemann limits and everything. And I had to do this in a few days to get them up to speed, 6 weeks worth of classes that they had completely missed. And can you imagine them going into other calculus courses trying to do well based on the fact that, you know, they didn't know what was going on? So anyway, I sat down there, and that was where the petition came from. These students went across campus with a petition, and I saw the petition. I didn't know about this, but I later went in. I was called into the head of the math department's office, and I looked on his desk. He showed me, he said, this is a petition from these students. They want you to teach their class. And I'm like, holy cow. They were like notebook pages ripped out, and these students had signed a petition, 395 students, for me to teach their calculus class. But the point is that you can learn this stuff in a short order. They drag it out and drag it out and spend too much time, and I think that's where they lose a lot of students, because it's not that complicated. Solving the problems at the back of the book, that's complicated. That takes time. That takes concentration. You can't do that in 5 minutes, because each problem shows you a different aspect of, say, calculus or whatever sub-logic, whatever subject you're studying. And I've taught them all. I've taught every subject in mathematics that exists, and then some. But the point is that the human mind needs to be developed. And you can develop the mind to look at patterns on tables and see more than three. But it takes time. It takes development. It takes somebody that can show you how to do these things. And that's where education should be concentrating, is on developing the young minds. And it's not doing it. It's failing, 100% failing to develop the minds of young people and their interests. Every kid has different interests. You know, every kid has different skills, and they're not being developed. When you sit, you know, millions of kids down and teach them the same thing, all, you know, and after 12 years, they've all learned the same thing. That's not education. That's not, the reason they do that is because it's easy for the teachers. It's easy for the schools. They have a nice building. They go there. They get a nice paycheck. They get a nice retirement. It's very easy for the teachers, but it doesn't provide decent education for the kids. So anyway, that's why I'm doing my paid casts, by the way, is to develop a real educational system that is going back to the Greeks. And so that's something I'm working on. It's a lot of work, believe me. It's a lot of work. And so if you're interested in that, go to my paid casts. But also just understand that education today is in a real crisis, absolute crisis. I just want to talk about one other issue, and this is something that affects your life very much. It's unfolding right now, and that is that, remember, ISIS was basically defeated. Well, they're coming back now. They're coming through Turkey, and they're invading the countries that were left with power vacuums thanks to the Hillary Clinton State Department. Remember where they took Gaddafi out and killed him? Well, that left a power vacuum in that region. And now the roosters are coming back to roost. And ISIS is being funded. And this is also, you got to understand, the CIA, the dark side of the CIA, is over there drumming this up. They're the ones that created ISIS under Obama. They're the ones that funded ISIS, and now they're doing it again. And, of course, Trump has to react to this. It's an unfortunate situation, but a lot of the distress in the world has been caused by the CIA basically developing these counter groups around the world and causing chaos. And then, of course, the United States has to come in with the white hat and solve the issue. So that's going on again. This does affect you in the United States because there's an increase in militant terrorism in the world. And this is not good. This is not good for anybody. My main science topic tonight, I'll be talking about the results I'm getting. People are writing in for their local water study. And I'm trying to keep up with that. If you've written in for this and you have not heard back yet, just be patient. We're trying to work through these. And I'm primarily doing this myself, as I do with most of my things. So just be a little patient with me. But the idea is you send me an email with your zip code and your water company that's on your water bill, and I'll go into the government databases and send you a water analysis, a real water analysis of what is in your water. It's not just a broad spectrum list of what's in the whole United States. No, this is a list of toxins that are in your water. And your local water company will tell you, if you go ask them, you say, how's the water here? How does it test out? They will tell you simply that it complies with all federal standards. Well, the federal standards are decades old and haven't been rewritten and don't really test the water. That's all I can tell you. But there are tests of water in all these municipalities. They were required to actually do real tests, but they never published them. And so they never informed the public, you, the public. So you can find out what's in your water by emailing me. So the email address is at the top of my webpage, jmccsci.com. I'll give it to you on the air here. No, I won't. Just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. It's a long email address, and I don't want you to write it down and get it wrong, and then I don't receive your email. So go to that webpage, right at near the top. There's a little note, how to get a hold of me. And send your zip code and your water company name, and I will go into the database for you and get what is in your water, and I'll send you that email. So anyway, that's very important. And but the thing I'm finding out here is that I am horrified. I mean, some of these are very little communities. Some of these are big cities, everything in between. Some of them are, medium-sized cities, etc. And I'm just aghast at the cancer-causing chemicals that are in the water. And here is the issue, and I'm going to spend the next decade pounding on this issue, that when you step into the shower and you are taking a shower, you're breathing in that vapor. All those chemicals go into vapor form, and you're breathing them in, and it's hitting your skin. That hot water is driving these chemicals right into your skin, the biggest organ receptor in your body, and those chemicals are going in, and they're cumulative. So these build up. You don't eliminate them from your body. They keep building up and building up. And I'm convinced that this is the main cause of the high rate and increasing rate of cancer in the United States. I was traveling a little while ago, and I went in, I took a shower, and I could smell the chlorine or whatever chemical it is they put in there. I could smell it in my arms because I don't have chlorine in my water. Typically there's none. It's free from chemicals completely. I don't even have to filter it because there's no chemicals to begin with. But if you're living in the United States, you're being barraged with chemicals. But anyway, I showered in this, and my arms turned red. the skin on my forearms turned red and it kind of itched. And I'm like, holy cow, what if you did this every day? You know, you would be getting, you know, this stuff is going into your body. And that's, you know, that's my opinion why there's the high rate of cancer is because people are showering, they're drinking this water, brushing their teeth with it. So that's why I'm promoting whole house water filters. And the sale that I had on, if it's still there by the time you listen to this show, it's coming off because I'm going through many new layers of marketing for the whole house water filter. So if it's still on sale with free shipping, you can get that right after this show. But that's coming down pronto. No more 10% off and no more free shipping. It costs me about $200 to send these units out to you if you're in the 48 states. So there's free shipping to the 48 states, plus a 10% discount on the price. But that's going away. Like I say, if you're interested, buy tonight because it won't be there tomorrow. But what I'm trying to do is concentrate on the major problems in the world in terms of educating people with real science, giving you clean water, providing people in remote areas with energy with the wing generator. Now I have the shipping containers there. Also have new manna food, storage food. That's very good pricing on my webpage. So at any rate, this is what I'm going to spend my next 10 years doing. And then also just improving, working on improving anything that's going on here. But also the wing generator, if you're interested in your independent energy source, if you live on a farm or a ranch or you're out in an area where there's no zoning, that's usually the catch where people is that they're in an area where zoning prohibits them from putting up a wind generator. And wind is the solution. Wind blows day and night, winter, summer, rain or shine, you know, no matter what, the wind is blowing. And so that's the true source of energy. The actual energy comes from the discharge of the solar capacitor. That's what provides our wind on this planet. And it's one of the best renewable energy sources because it's there every day. So if you have good wind, then convert it into energy. You can heat your house, charge your automobile, get an electric car, etc. And this is the future. So the wing generator actually is an item that works. So just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And also these months coming up, I'll be concentrating on space science in a positive sense. What should we be doing? This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.